nothing's going to find this out there. It will never travel in another solar system. Extraterrestrials, the chances of them picking up out of space is so, so minuscule. But they inherently knew the value of trying anyway. And everyone agreed on it enough to send it. And that how much work has to go into building this thing and to getting it out there and to deciding what goes on it. And we all unanimously were like, yeah, we're going to send love.
If you guys are like me, and globally speaking, you probably are, a head with certain orifices, a hand or two, some kind of leggy things on the bottom. If you're like me, you're always chasing after a feeling of awe. Which is a hard feeling to describe, but I'm pretty certain that everyone on the planet knows that feeling. It's the feeling when you taste something or smell something or see something that just puts you in your place. It just makes you feel small. To me, that feeling is better than any drug. I mean, honestly speaking, sometimes drugs have helped me find it. But also, sometimes drugs have helped me find a terrible feeling of needing to poop my pants for 8 hours in a desert while everyone else around me is having a blast. So, I don't know, drugs are weird. They don't always give you what you want. But awe is different. It's inexplicable, and it's fleeting. The place where you found it the first time, the second time, there's not as much there, and if you come back for a third time, you have to really scratch around to find it. It's like the fading smell of somebody in an old jacket. You know, it's just, it goes away, and then eventually it's gone. I think that's because awe wants you to chase it. I know I'm anthropomorphizing a feeling right now, but I'm also talking into a microphone alone in my bedroom, so just give me this. Awe wants you to chase after it, to follow it to new countries, the tops of mountains, in my case, a late-night barbecue stand on a side street in Shanghai that, ooh, you just know is going to do a real number on my guts, but, you know, it's worth it. It's like your own personal manic pixie dream girl without the weird 2008 objectification of women in ukuleles and square-cut bangs. Awe is great, and I always need more of it in my life, and my guess is you probably do too. And that's why I love this topic. It's about one of the most beautiful things that people have ever done, and they did it partly for the fact that it was just a really beautiful, awe-inspiring thing to do. I hope you guys enjoy this one as much as I did. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to At Least There's This, a podcast about some of the small, good things in our world of chaos. Or, well, going towards chaos. It's this idea called entropy. There was this physicist, Boltzmann, and this was back in the 1800s. He was a real chubby, strange-looking man. He had a giant, bushy, bushy, awful beard, and he just wasn't a happy fella. And he realized that everything was slowly losing heat, going towards heat death, and, oh, well, that's neither here nor there. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I've been gone for a while. I went on my annual one-week pilgrimage in the desert just so that I could come back and be a little happier, a little more vibrant, a little bit more obnoxious when I'm talking very loudly about my experiences at Burning Man out in the street. That's where I am. And boy, oh boy, has the world gone to shit while I was gone. It was weird when I left. It was weirder when I got back. I have no clue what's going on with this Mahler thing. Our president is just a pizza box, I think, with a face drawn on it. That's what's happening. So things are garbage. But maybe you're not in our current timeline. Maybe you're far away from where I am right now. You've just discovered perhaps a thumb drive with my podcast on it, and you don't speak the English language. Really, you're probably just tripping about this crazy noise that's coming to you, you sentient gas cloud. And if that's the case, well, strap in, because you're about to trip balls on our weird wavelengths. If that isn't the case, and you're listening to this maybe a couple weeks after I've recorded it, we all know that the world can feel immediate and broken and daunting, and like everything currently is the only thing there's ever been. But in a world where everything feels like it's closing in around us, at least there's
Voyager 1. What?
What a baritone on you, Soren Bowie.
Let me turn up something here sure that I can hear myself.
I can hear you nice in the cans.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, okay. That's good.
Guys, I am with someone who I've been listening to on podcasts forever, another Cracked alum, one of the greats, Soren Bowie, and we're going to talk about the Voyager 1 mission.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I am so pleased. I'm pleased as punch that you're here. But before we get into that, let's chat about you, Soren. Can you intro yourself to my audience real quick?
Yeah, I used to, probably where most people know me from is Cracked. That's where I used to write, and I was in a lot of videos there, and did a lot of the podcasts. And now I work at a show called American Dad, which is on TBS. And I grew up in Colorado, came out here for college, met my wife there, and then started living out the American dream, basically. I'm not by any designs. I mean, it just sort of fell into place for me because things sort of do that in a Ferris Bueller kind of way. I have a wife. I have a son who's now three, and we live in a house in South LA, and I work in television.
But just so you guys can conceptualize, Soren, he sounds like he's just a normal humdrum guy, but he's got that kind of Colorado fitness about him where, like, yeah, he could probably mountain bike his way up the 101, you know, go through the Angeles Crest and find himself back home in a couple of days. So have that in your mind. Soren, are you an optimist, pessimist, neither, both, whatever?
I think that I'm an optimist in general. Okay. In theory, I'm definitely an optimist. Individual people, if I'm like people that I see every day in my life that are strangers to me, mm-hmm. I don't have high hopes for them in general. I always feel like they're just not quite paying attention enough, and it really frustrates me. But in general, I think that humanity makes the right decisions when it counts.
So you're talking about, like, on an individual scale, we're fucking up constantly.
Yes.
But on a global scale, and I've used this metaphor too much, so I'm sorry to my audience, it's like a Ouija board and we're all pushing the planchette.
And we're getting into the right place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What makes you think that?
Well, things like Voyager, actually. Okay. They're along the way, it always feels, and I guess this is because we only get the stories through history that people want to tell, but it always feels like it turns out for us that, you know, right now we have so many people on Earth and that's really terrifying. And that we're this, like, of all the exotic species on Earth, like, we're the most dangerous one. And the Earth would be fine without us. It would do much, much better without us. But we're also, everybody along the way, there are so many people born now who are thinking about ways to make it better and fix that problem without having to do something drastic, like cut out half the population. No Thanos shit is going to happen here.
There are Thanoses, but I feel like the Thanoses are always the least creative.
Yeah. Yeah, there feels like there's always somebody who's on your side or like is putting the thought in. And that's what matters. There's somebody out there who wants the best possible solution as opposed to the easiest.
I feel like based on what you said about optimism, how a lot of people aren't paying attention, people paying attention and thinking is something that gives you some optimism.
Yes. Anybody who – it's clear that they've thought it through all the way. And whatever it may be, like whatever quadrant they're actually thinking about, somebody who takes the time to think it through completely, I really, really – that always makes me tear up a little bit.
Well, since we're talking about people who think very deeply and tearing up, I think that's a perfect – place for us to segue, don't you?
Absolutely.
And segue, here's my segue. Segue sounds a lot like Sagan. And there we go.
And now we're here.
So let's talk about Voyager 1. This is something I'm going to warn my audience. I'm working on it. I know that when I get excited, I tend to talk a little too much in an interview podcast. I will tamper that down, but we are talking about probably my favorite person who's ever been alive and something he did. But I'm going to let Soren take it from here. We are talking about Voyager 1.
Then this might be a problem because I also, when I talk about, well, it's rare that I talk about Voyager in person with anyone. I'll preface that now because no one gives a shit. Generally, it's hard to like get people excited because you have to go through so many steps to tell them why it matters so much. But I also I will jump around a lot because I get so excited. And I also might, like, cry.
That's good. I'm probably going to cry with you. I just got back from a week-long drug trip, and we're talking about Carl Sagan. So, my man, we're crying today.
Okay, so I'll give you, like, the cold, dry logistics of it first.
Okay.
Voyager was a satellite that was – oh, there's two Voyagers. The Voyager project was Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Voyager 2 was launched first, and then Voyager 1 was on like a steeper trajectory towards Saturn and Jupiter. They wanted to go get these – a lot of information from those two particular planets. And so they sent out these Voyagers. They could take photographs and send them all back to Earth. And we learned a lot about Saturn and Jupiter from these. We learned about their moons, moons that we didn't even know they had, that there were volcanoes on some of Jupiter's moons, which we didn't know was possible. We that was like the primary mission to sort of extend the senses of humanity to these places so that we could actually understand them a little bit better. And then the plan after that was to slingshot them around the orbit of Saturn and just fire them out into space. And that was the secondary mission. And so I like to think of it as like we're extending the senses of man, and then we are extending the sensibilities of humanity out there, because then we wanted to have these things out in the atmosphere, out beyond the solar system, not because we thought we might learn anything out there, but because we wanted to send a piece of ourselves out there. And on each one of these Voyagers, there's a record. It's a golden record in a golden leaf that's fairly easy to ascertain how to use it. They've done a rudimentary description on the front, not in English, but in like the simplest thing they could think of to show somebody how this is played. And on it, they've got – well, we'll go into what's on it because it's really great. But just in terms of like the cold logistics of it, this is something that now – Voyager 1 is further out than Voyager 2. Voyager 2 is nowhere near as far. Voyager 1 is really exciting because it's beyond the reach of the sun at this point. It's not within the sun's gravitational pull. It's outside the heliosphere, and it's out in the Oort cloud, and it will be for like another 27,000 years. That's basically the rest of space that it's in right now. And I think in order to appreciate how great Voyager is, you have to kind of grasp how big space is. And so if you think of like Earth, you could fit – I'm trying to think how many you could fit in the sun. You could fit 1.3 million Earths in the sun. And then within our galaxy – I'm sorry, within our solar system, you can fit 278 billion suns. So like that's huge. And what we've sent out there is basically it's I'm not even fair to call it a message in a bottle, because a message in a bottle, you can actually contextualize how big a bottle is within a sea. This is like so much bigger. That would be like a bottle would be in a sea would be like a sun in the solar system. And this is way, way bigger than that.
It's like a message in an atom of water in the sea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's so minuscule and small. And the chances of it ever being found by somebody or a species or a life out there is so inconsequential and tiny that it almost feels completely feeble and silly that we sent it. And that's part of the reason I love it so much, because of what's on it and what's on that golden record.
Before we get into what's on the golden record, you said something just now that I found really beautiful, and I don't know if you'd intended to, and you said that we were extending our senses, so what we can see, but we're also extending our sensibility. And that, to me, is the legacy of Carl Sagan. And I want to know if that was something you intended, and is that something that you feel?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that he's somebody who I'd love to have to hear him on this podcast, honestly, if we could.
If some genie came and I could speak to anyone in the world across the booth from you, it would be him.
He's somebody who, if you had a pessimist and you allowed them to talk to Carl Sagan for a dinner, I think that they would come out of it an optimist. Because he just makes you feel better about the universe and the world and the state of everything. He's so poetic in the description of it that it all feels very grandiose, but also like you're consequential in it. And I love that.
Yeah. Truly, truly meaningful. Can you talk about what you mean by sensibility?
Yeah. I mean, what humans are like on our very best day. He was in charge of creating this golden record project, of deciding what was going to go on it and what was going to be our first contact, hypothetically, with some other species, some interterrestrial or extraterrestrial. And he wanted to put on there the very best of what we had to offer. And he's the perfect person to have in charge of that project, because there's so many things we could send into space. We could have sent a show of strength. We could have shown our clinical intelligence. We could have shown what a robust and tenacious species we are. But we didn't. Instead, we sent love out there. And I love that. I like that a lot.
I describe myself as very hippie adjacent. I'm not a hippie per se, but a lot of my friends are, and I – I do a lot of things that sort of live in that sphere, but I'm also very much a skeptic and very much a, you know, a brain first person materialist in a philosophical sense, not, you know, not about bling. And that's why I love this story so much, because even when it's led by one of the best scientists of its time, it's one of the most optimistic, loving, spiritual things I think that the species has ever done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he is the perfect person to have done it, because he is like us on our best day. He's clinical and coldly scientific, but at the same time absurdly optimistic. And he's complex but also lighthearted. And that's what we all strive to be constantly, is that find that line of duality.
That's very well put. Yeah. Jan Levin's kind of got it. You ever read anything by Jan Levin?
I haven't.
She wrote Black Hole Blues. Okay. I recommend that a lot. It's about the LIGO project.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
There's a astrophysicist named Michio Kaku, who I think is the closest I've seen.
You like Michio Kaku?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know his work. I know of him.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's keep talking about – let's talk about the Golden Record. God,
yes.
There's so much I want to talk about.
Yes.
But let's do Golden Record. So this record – was a record. It's hard to ask proper questions. Why was it? And also, rather than just what was it, because this isn't a history podcast,
yeah,
why do you, Soren, because you're kind of tearing up right now, why does this make you feel what you're feeling?
Yeah. The backstory of it, mostly. I mean, there are even the driest parts of the record are also tear-inducing, but I'll go through those first. They were trying to decide what to send and what was going to be the best representation of not just humanity but the Earth out there, as like we are stewards of this universe. And in deciding what they were going to send, Carl Sagan had a team of cosmologists working on it with him, and they would find pictures and be like, okay, well, this is a sea turtle swimming over a reef and there's some fish behind it. And then they would think about why each one of those pieces of the photograph mattered. And they would send a DNA structure. They decided to send pictures of the human reproductive system. And as cells, the way that cells reproduce, what's that called?
Mitosis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cells in mitosis. And just give like such a macro and micro smattering of what it means to be on Earth. Some of the things they found are so silly to me. Like there's a big crocodile. And there's a guy just measuring the tail of the crocodile. And it's the crocodile's up on its back. It's on its like belly up. And the guy's just measuring its tail. And I'm like, okay, well, they had their reasons, I'm sure. They also put a lot of classical music on there. There are songs from all over the world and from centuries. You know, all the way back, some of the big hits like Beethoven and Bach are on there, and Mozart. But then
you know, those
got,
big hits.
Then they've
those
also
fucking
got,
jams. Number one with a bullet.
They've also got Johnny B. Goode on there. They've found ancient Chinese songs, Indian songs, and then they've got a greeting in 55 different languages, including whale, how humpbacks greet each other. They put that on there because they isolated like, oh, this is how they greet each other. They should be represented. And then there are things that they did an essay that's just a sound essay of things that they thought would be representative of us. They did a baby crying, a mom comforting a child for the first time, a mom like having just delivered a baby, comforting that child. They did the sound of a kiss. There's just a lot of really beautiful things on there. But the one thing that really puts it over the top for me is there's a EEG and an EKG of Annie Druyan, who she was the project director on this. And she sat in a hospital and they took a sampling of like the sounds of her brain and her body as she thought about civilization and she thought about humanity and she thought about the Earth and what it means to live here. And then the last 2 minutes of it, she privately just thought about Carl and Carl Sagan. And it was 2 days after she and Carl Sagan had fallen in love. So she wanted to put on there the sound of what it means to be in love and then just send that into space at like 38,000 miles an hour and have that be the thing that represents humanity long after we're like billions of years from now when we're ash in the sun, that will still be out there representing us.
Yeah. That's so beautiful. The whole story, because Carl and Anne's relationship gave birth to almost every book he ever published and to the Cosmos series, which you kind of have a tentative connection to, right? Because you work for a show like by Seth MacFarlane, and he's also making Cosmos now.
Yes.
But like that whole endeavor, we attach Carl's name to it, but also Anne Durian was essential in all of that. And their love made all of that science communication more than just numbers. It made it spiritually fulfilling and made it whole.
Yeah, it gave us a reason to care
about,
because there's people in your everyday life who are like, who gives a shit about space? Like, why would we care about space? When we have everything going on here, all the problems and everything that you're facing here, why does anyone give a shit about what's going on out there? And it's like, no, it's inherently important. It matters. And we all kind of know it in our heart if you search deep enough. And these two are really good at explaining why it's important. And that's what Cosmos is.
Can you speak to why it's important to you, Soren?
Yeah. so I it did, we're living in a tough situation right now.
Right.
We have a president who you read about him in the news, and it's always disheartening. And you read about what people are doing around him in his circle who are trying to keep him in power, even though they hate him because he will allow them to get their policies through, and how diabolical that is. And then you see your own side. In this case, my own side would be the Democratic Party, who are not a lot better. When they tried to crash Obamacare, they were in the House singing Hey, Goodbye to the Republican Party, thinking they'll be ousted in November. But they're also like, they're treating it like a game, basically. Like, they're excited to see their team winning because they made this terrible decision. And no one's really thinking about what people actually want and how scary that is. And we've built a system where the representatives can't support the number of people who they're representing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the bigger macro issues. Like, we've done irreparable damage to the planet. At this point, no one's even thinking about the possibility of reversing global warming. We're just trying to mitigate it at this point. Mm-hmm. We've accepted the fact that we are beyond repair. And we're just going to try and keep this thing alive as long as we can. And you watch these species dying all over the place around you. You think, like, you go to sleep thinking about, oh, fuck, polar bears. Fuck. Like, they're just out on these ice just drowning because they don't have it. They can't hunt anymore. They're moving down into out from the Arctic and down into, like, Alaska and stuff. And then they're mating with grizzly bears. And they're just, like, trying to stay alive in some way. And there's so many things going wrong. And it's really nice to think about. I don't know if you know, if you've ever seen that picture of Earth from Voyager.
The pale blue dot,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So when Voyager...
That's the most beautiful speech I think that's ever been written.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So as Voyager was traveling out to Jupiter and Saturn, we had never sent anything that far before. And it turned around, it took a picture of Earth from out there. And Earth is so, so small. And Carl Sagan has a really great speech that he does about everything that's ever happened, all the wars, all of the famines, anything, all the loves, like everything that's happened, all happened on this one little tiny
spot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena.
If you're not crying, what the fuck is wrong with you?
And to realize that it in the greater scheme of things, maybe none of this matters. It's really easy to get bogged down. It's really easy to get bogged down in our everyday lives and what we think of as going on right now. But in our greater historical context, like, we come out of these things, and we will come out of these things.
Yeah.
And how comforting that is to know. And also that there are people who are on the right team, and they're doing the right things, and they're sending things out. There's so much – I mean, think about trying to send something into space like this today. It wouldn't happen because there's so much bureaucratic red tape, and everyone would, on both sides would cry about the waste of – they spent millions of dollars on a futile project, a project that was designed – That will never. Everyone knows it will never reach its success. Nothing's going to find this out there. It will never travel into another solar system. Extraterrestrials. The chances of them picking up out of space is so minuscule. But they inherently knew the value of trying anyway, and everyone agreed on it enough to send it. And that how much work has to go into building this thing and to getting it out there, and to deciding what goes on it. And we all unanimously were like, yeah, we're going to send love.
Yeah, it's art.
I actually wrote down I copied a thing that Jimmy Carter had written when this was created, and it's so wonderful. He wrote a whole thing about why we did it, that explains, like, here's what we're going to actually glean from its process and everything. But then the last paragraph he just writes, this is a present from a small distant world, a token of our sound, our science, our images, our music, our thoughts, and our feelings. We are attempting to survive our time so we may live into yours. We hope someday, having solved the problems we face, to join a community of galactic civilizations. This record represents our hope and our determination and our goodwill in a vast and awesome universe.
That's so fucking beautiful. It's like everyone in America was doing something meaningful. We had a president who, I know people have very negative views of Jimmy Carter because he was weak and silly, maybe, but it seems like everyone was kind of lined up at that time to care about beauty,
yeah,
and love, and how rare is that?
Yeah,
you know,
and that this gesture is so futile makes it even better.
Yeah,
that it was like, you think about even what that record can contain on it now. Your phone can contain millions and billions of more information than what's on that record. But they think they knew at the time, like, this is all we've got. This is what we can create.
Yeah.
This is what we can send. And we don't know if anyone will find it, but we have to try. And they did. And everyone was like, yeah, of course, we have to try.
Yeah. What about that trying and futility gets you? Because it seems like that's something that hits you right in the heart.
I don't know. It feels sort of like Lord of the Rings-ish, I guess, where it's like you have to give it to a hobbit, man. You have to give this extraordinary power to a hobbit because they're the only ones who can do it. They're the ones who are they're inconsequential, and they're so small that everyone else around them forgets about them. And they also have the most heart. Like, they're the only ones who can't be corrupted by this thing. And they're, because they're the only ones who could do it, like, they're also so vulnerable too. Like, where their strengths are, they lack in every other area.
Uh-huh.
And in, like, the grand scheme of what humanity is, I feel like we're very much the same way. We're so easily corrupted, and we're so vulnerable in a lot of ways. But in this one very specific way, we're the best at it.
And what is that?
We want things to succeed. Like, we want everything around us to be, I don't want to say, like, thrive doesn't even feel right. It's hard to articulate, but, like, you think about every species on our planet has the baby schema. Well, all the mammals have the baby mm-hmm. schema. Do you know what the baby schema is?
Explain.
You are adoring of a face that has big eyes, a small nose, and has, like, a big head.
Mm-hmm.
And small mouth, big eyes. And it's the face of a baby. It's the face of every puppy, cheetah. Like, every mammal has this. And it inherently makes the rest of us want to take care of it. That's why there are videos on YouTube of, like, a cheetah killing an antelope and then seeing its baby is there and, like, trying to take care of the baby for a while.
Mm.
Or like, they're no good at it. I mean, the thing dies within, like, a week or even shorter than that, sometimes overnight. But there's something that's triggered in them that, like, wants to take care of this thing. And we want to see the most futile things succeed. And I think that's what we were trying to do was like, we're like, we know this is futile, but like, what if it did? What if it did? We want to believe in underdog stories, like how much we love the underdog stories in sports movies. We want the little guy to make it. And that's just part of us.
It's so hopeful.
It's in our ingrained in us.
Right.
From it's a priori. Like it's not even something that we learned early on. Uh-huh. I can see it in my son when we're like reading a book or something like that. That he already knows it. Like he picks up on it. He's like, that's the guy. Like that's the one who we want.
Uh-huh.
The one who's going through the trials and tribulations. We want him to come out the other side.
I guess this Voyager project sees us then as the underdog. We're
Absolutely.
Because we shot a fucking hunk of junk out into space and looked back at ourselves, saw like we are the underdogs. We're going through a bunch of trials and tribulations. Boy, do I hope we succeed.
It was basically we shot a compact car out there. That's about how big this thing is. And we're just like, well, it's the smallest thing we can still get out of that. I mean, it's the biggest thing we can still get out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And maybe someone will pick it up. The fact that even the trope of message in the bottle exists in the first place is testament to our like whimsical optimism.
Yeah.
That you can put a message in a bottle, or little kids attach a note to a balloon, a hot air balloon, and send it off. The fact that we think somebody out there will find it or read what we wrote is so absurd and impossible, but we want to believe it so bad that we do.
I'm having this image that I would love to hear you speak on because I think it's something that we've touched on a little bit, but it's the difference of Voyager 1 and Elon Musk's Rocket Man.
Yeah.
Right? Like they're two, you said compact car, right?
Yeah.
It's a compact car in space, but they have the most different flavors I can possibly imagine. Do you follow me with
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. One feels like a demonstration. There's pageantry to it, and the other one feels like a genuine hello.
Yeah.
One feels like it's exclusively for us and the other one feels like it's aware of its own historical context. It knows that it's going to be out there when we're all gone.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not for us. I mean, it ends up being for us just because of what's actually on it, but it's a photograph of what we were, and what we were at our very best is what they wanted to represent. And I don't think Elon wants that. I think Elon wants to show he wants to do something that would be funny and like put a man in a car out there, in a car that I made.
Yeah.
And humanity will love this. This is going to be great. He's not actually interested in learning anything or like going any further. It's I wouldn't even necessarily qualify it as an extension of our sensibilities. I think it's an extension of his ego.
Yeah. Feels like a narrowing of our sensibilities.
Yeah.
We're taking it to space, but we're doing the same shit we've been doing.
Yeah.
Like a billboard what if a billboard, but space?
Yeah. And there's a lot of that within the space program that already previously existed. Certainly putting a flag on the moon is of the same flavor, where it's like, here's an American flag and we're putting this up here because we were here first.
Yeah.
And the reason that the space race existed in the first place is sort of selfish reasons.
Yeah.
And it is a narrowing of sensibilities, but this somehow feels different.
Well, that's
Voyager got out of that loop.
I feel like that's what makes Carl Sagan and Ann Durian so amazing, is that they took this thing and they were able to escape the gravity well of bureaucracy and bullshit and turn – it's like someone who's able to take a bunch of guns and turn them into a statue.
That's such a great way of putting it, because – what we did was we fired this thing out of our solar system. We got it away from this orbit that we're all stuck in.
Yeah.
And everything else it exists within this orbit. And we're all like, for better or worse, like we're just stuck here. And we finally found something that we could fire beyond it.
Yeah.
And that could exist outside of it. And we did it. So, and it's just perfect. That's what's on there.
Insane when you like think about just how, not just how big space is, but like what it would look like to like just be in a nebula. You're like, fuck what I'm dealing with right now. Like, what if I was just there? That would be sure different, wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is going to be a point where Voyager passes within 1.7 light years of this other solar system.
That's so crazy.
Which is still so inconstant. You can't even conceive of how big that is.
Right.
How far away that is. But still, it feels so close because we can put a one on it and then be like, it's just one light year.
Right.
And that's about the probably the closest it will come to a solar system. It does feel – we just can't – the enormity is impossible to calculate because it feels so simple. It feels like, oh, you send it out there and there's so many stars out there. And if each one of those has a solar system around it, it's going to hit one of those.
Right.
But it's just – it's not going to do that.
Well, it's just like with the Oort cloud, the fact that it's – so the Oort cloud is a most things that surround the sun in an elliptical pattern. Mm-hmm. The Oort cloud is a
spherical.
Right. So it's like an asteroid belt kind of, but unlike Star Wars, it's not – you don't have to be Han Solo to like navigate through this shit.
No.
Yeah.
It's kind of, they talk about it as a plasma a lot, which I also don't totally understand. I don't even think they understand because – Oort, so that was the guy who it was named after because he just hypothesized that this thing was out there.
Yeah.
Until we sent Voyager, we were like, well, we'll just assume he's right. And then Voyager is passing through something we know because we get some information back from it. We're like, oh, I guess it exists. And they've speculated on how big they think it is. But we don't really know what's going on out there. We won't know for a very long time because Voyager is such limited information that's coming back from there. But it is cool to think that, like, we are getting some information back at this point. That as it's going through, we know when it left the heliosphere, and we know we have a sense of how far away it is and what it's what whether it's slowing down or whether it's speeding up. By the way, in 2020, they're shutting down like the functions of Voyager, which means that we'll lose a lot more from it at that point.
Yeah,
which is sort of sad. Like, it won't be able to recalibrate its positioning and things like that.
That is sad.
But it'll still go out there, which is that's the thing I care about most, I guess. It's just that having that the EKG and the EEG the blind optimism that those things could be decoded at some point. Just the sounds of somebody thinking about stuff that you could have a species that could decode that and be like, oh, this is what they were thinking of when they sent this is so silly. And
can you imagine though being on the opposite end of like receiving just what is this nonsense, but knowing how much intelligence was behind it, that something made like what are these stupid bleeps and bloops, but like maybe it means a lot.
Right.
Maybe it's a meaningful bleep and bloop.
And that's why when I look at the photos from it, I get so excited because I'm like, why the fuck does he care about a crocodile tail?
Yeah.
What was it about this? And so you just sit there and stare at a picture of a hawk for a while and you're like, why this one?
Yeah.
What was it? Because they thought everything through, and that's what it is somebody sitting there or a team of people sitting there and thinking through every single thing before they send it and being like, this is the one. This has to be the one.
Yeah. God, it's just the enormity of the idea of – like, what if somebody else found it? And dealing with the idea of, like, this – it's like reading about a lost civilization that you're never going to see. It's gone. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone, and you'll never go there. And you'll never meet anyone who ever lived there, right? We'll never see the Library of Alexandria. Never. But you can think about it.
Yeah. You're hungry for the details. You're
right.
Like, oh, man. I bet there was a Diomede. There's a whole epic about Diomedes in there that we never got.
Yeah. And if some civilization ever found the golden record, this thing that didn't exist to them, suddenly like an explosion, well, there's this place called Earth. And they had all this shit going on that we didn't know about. Like, how amazing is that? Like, well, maybe there are other Earths to look for. It's pretty beautiful.
I love it.
It's hard to encounter. It's hard to talk about.
Well, you have to talk about it on such a macro scale that you lose like the little details of it.
Yeah.
And so it falls through your fingers. You don't examine it. It just like melts in your hands.
I feel like we've hit every possible thing, but let's do the structured bit of the podcast. Let's do the big and little G just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
So you know that idea that I fuck around with on here, big G, little G good? I can reiterate.
Yeah, yeah.
So little G good is like good for me. Like, boy, this Topo Chico sparkling water we're both drinking refreshes me, and it's nice, and it you know, maybe reminds me of other nice times I've drunk. these good drinks. But the big G good is like the fact that we can make sparkling water as a species, right? It's good. I don't actually think sparkling water is big G good. I just like it. Yeah. But like it's something that's like truly good for the world. This world is a world worth living in where we can do amazing things that make this whole endeavor not like one more valuable than jumping off a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Does that track with you?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, cool. So we've talked a little about both, but I'd love to maybe hear you just vamp on... Let's start with the little G.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the little G, it was... that was harder for me to like contextualize when I was first researching Voyager, like long ago when I fell in love with this stuff.
Oh, well, how did you fall in love with it?
It was in 2012 and I just found out about it leaving the heliosphere. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And there are, you know, you lose a lot of, when you're a kid, how often you would be just arrested by the idea of space.
Mm-hmm.
But I see it in my son too, where he looks up and he sees stars and he's like, you can kind of, he's like encroaching on a realization of the enormity. And he doesn't quite have it yet, but he knows that there's something so big out there. Because we look in science books and things like that, we show them pictures of Saturn and everything. And you can do it now, but we just don't do it very frequently. Maybe when we're on drugs, we do it. I think that's the only time we really do it, where we're like, "Oh my God, it's so big! we're so small compared to everything that's out there."
Yeah,
and because I'm so small, like what do I do? How can I matter? And you're like, "Well, you just got to keep living your life and be the best you can be, and that's like your contribution here."
Yeah,
and so like that was what turned me onto it, and like that was the big G of it, of like the best of humanity is still I'm proud that's out there. The home team decided to send this, and I'm proud of our team for that. But the little G, it's hard to like think about those macro levels when you're just dealing with, when you're mired in the shit. When I look at my phone in the morning and the first thing I see is, you know, Trump saying treason. I'm like, there's no great pathway for me to get from there to, well, at least Voyager's out there,
right?
But there's, when I wrote an article about this because I was so inspired by it after I had read all this stuff. I wrote it for Cracked long ago about just one section was dedicated to Voyager. But when I wrote it, the woman who does the greetings in Portuguese on the record that's out there, her name, she lives in Brazil, and her name is Dr. Janet Sternberg, and she's a linguist and she calls herself a media ecologist. I don't really totally know what that means, but she reached out to me and said how beautiful it was and how thankful she was that I had done this. And that's where it was like, then it became a little G thing where I was like, oh my God, somebody attached to this, somebody whose voice is going to outlive all of us, that's going to outlive the earth. And I'm talking to them.
God.
I get to talk to somebody who will exist long, long, or at least their voice will exist so much longer than the sun. Was really exciting for me.
I was doing research on this because I'm a huge fan of Carl Sagan's, and I was so excited to talk to Soren about this. I was doing some research, and Anne and Carl decided to include some gamelan, which is like an I think it's Indonesian, kind of like xylophone, but it's like a big orchestral sort of thing. And there was a quote from them about how in gamelan, in that in the ideas behind that music, the music is always playing constantly. It's just, you're just like bringing it out into the world for everyone to hear when you actually play the gamelan. And they were like, oh yeah, that's what we're doing, right? Like,
yeah,
the music everywhere in the universe, it's always playing. We're just giving kind of what ours sounds like right here, right now, out into the universe. And it feels more like the truest form of art than any other art I've ever gotten my hands on. It's just art because just for its own fucking sake, we're just doing this thing because it's beautiful and it matters.
Yeah. The idea that there's a constant perpetual energy, and here's what that energy looks like synthesized through us.
Yeah. Here's how we feel it. This is our dance.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
It makes you... You've got a goofy grin on, and I bet I do too. And it's like, this is why we live. I mean, yeah, it's also to like have kids and perpetuate our species and love our families. But we're existing because we're existing. And how do we express that existence?
Yeah, how do we make it matter?
Right.
In any way? And it's so hard to make it matter.
It's so hard.
Especially when you send something out there and take a picture back at us and realize how small we are.
Yeah.
And how small we are even on that little tiny blue dot. It's like, well, then nothing matters, right? And you think, no. You think it through all the way. You're like, no, it does. All of it matters.
Yeah.
All of it. Every single – now it's not just you who matters, but now think about that on an even more micro level than you. What's the little blue dot to you?
Yeah.
Like there are things within your own life that are that small little blue dot, but the things that are happening within it are so important on a very, very micro level, microscopic level, that like you influence all of that all the time.
If you guys listening to Soren and I have ever taken a hallucinogenic drug – this is, if you haven't, this is a lot like what it sounds like.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of like, oh shit, everything matters. Oh boy. Oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like the best kinds of art put you in that place. And I think the golden record on Voyager is, just like.
It's, you know what it is? We're obsessed with the biggest. Mm-hmm. Like, we want to know what the biggest end is. Like, well, we don't care, like, what's bigger than the next thing. We want to know what the very biggest thing is.
Yeah.
Or, like, what the end is.
Right.
Like, what succeeds – whatever you've got in front of you, what succeeds it? And so, like, we're obsessed with that in sports. We're obsessed with that mm-hmm. in writing, like, in everything. Like, mm-hmm. And people argue about who their favorite artist is. Like, what a silly thing to do.
Right.
Like, there's no one that's better than the other necessarily, or the one that's the final, like, the absolute best, the platonic ideal, like that.
Right.
That doesn't exist. But we're obsessed with the idea of that as opposed to obsessing over where we exist within it. So in that same way, we're like, the Earth looks so small. Oh, well, then the universe is big. Well, what if there's like, what's the biggest part of the universe, or what's the biggest species in the universe?
Right.
Instead of looking the other direction of like, well, you're right in the middle of something. You are on that blue dot. But there are a lot of things there are just as many things that are smaller than you.
Yeah.
And on a micro and not just like physically, in like an emotional level, an energy level, there are so many things that are so much smaller than you, and so many things that are so much bigger than you. And you just have to figure out why you're this particular.
Right.
You exist as this particular being.
You're here right now.
Yeah.
And like trying to find the biggest thing. Also, probably there is no biggest thing.
No.
It just keeps right. on going. And like, well, who cares? Just be here right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good art does that. And I feel like the golden record is one of the best things we've done in that case.
I agree.
Yeah. Man. You definitely aren't getting a hard interview on this one.
I'm not picking it apart.
No.
Poking holes in it.
Yeah, no, I very much agree. Had you seen Cosmos or anything like that before you found out about this?
I did, yeah. I watched Cosmos when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have you don't have like a developed emotional sense yet. And
yeah.
So it was just telling me about space. That's
yeah.
the only, I didn't understand the poetry of it or anything like that.
Yeah.
And then when Carl Sagan died, somebody created a song of what they turned one of his speeches into a song, or one of his narratives into a song. And it's really beautiful and great.
What's the song called?
I don't know. It starts with him going, whoop, whoop.
Is it Symphony of Science?
It might be.
Because
yeah.
that dude has a lot of like cool, he like remixes science stuff. I listen to him frequently because I'm a dork. Of like him remixing scientists like Sagan and Stephen Hawking and Brian Cox and stuff into like kind of pretty okay EDM tracks.
Yeah, that's basically what this is. Uh-huh. And that's where I was like, I rediscovered the the kind of beauty of what he was saying, and I was like, oh, this guy, I need to watch more. I need to check out more. Yeah. And then I started to. And then I can't remember if that was independent of Voyager or not, but I remember just hearing about the Voyager was leaving the solar system and thinking to myself, well, that's the only thing we'll ever send out there until we actually know what we're looking for.
Right.
Until we have a concrete reason to go. We're not doing that again.
Yeah.
We won't just do it on a whim because we want to send some love out there. Like that's not us anymore. That's not this species. And how exciting it is that it is out there.
Yeah. It's almost like they just like the first time Alexander Graham Bell picked up a phone and like said something. It's like, this was the first time we could just like fucking shoot shit into space. Like, let's do something good.
Yeah.
And like now no one just picks up a phone and goes like, hey, what's up? You know, you like have to have a reason to get on the phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's, I actually want to look it up real quickly. Do you know who George Mallory is?
The name rings a bell, but
George Mallory was the first guy potentially to have summited, Everest.
Right.
Nobody really knows if he actually made it up there or not. You know, these guys were going before there was the Hillary step or like there was AIDS along the way.
Uh-huh.
And they also didn't have even Gore-Tex. They were climbing up there in tweed jackets. Like blazers, basically.
It's so easy to make fun of like the colonial English and also like point out how awful and monstrous they were. But there's also a bit where you're like, they must have been really fucking tough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like walk up there with a mustache and tweed, huh?
And so they thought maybe he did it because they did find his body eventually. And he had his goggles tucked into his jacket, into his breast pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been wearing his goggles on the way up and he wouldn't have been wearing them on the way down because it would have started to get dark.
Uh-huh.
So they suspect that maybe he made it. But before he went, everyone was like, so much of humanity was like, why? Like, why are you going? And so in an interview, he said, people ask me, what is the use of climbing Everest? And my answer must at once be, it is of no use. There is not the slightest prospect of any gain whatsoever. Oh, we may learn a little bit about the behavior of the human body at altitudes, and the possible medical and possibly medical men may turn our observations to some account for the purpose of aviation, but otherwise nothing will come of it. We shall not bring back a single bit of gold or silver, not a gem, nor any coal or iron. If you cannot understand that there is something in man which responds to the challenge of this mountain and goes out to meet it, that the struggle is the struggle of life itself, upward and forever upward, then you won't see why we go. What we get from this adventure is sheer joy. And joy is, after all, the end of life. We do not live to eat and make money. We eat and make money to be able to live. That is what life means and what life is for. And that feels very much like what Voyager is.
It's
if you don't understand inherently why this is valuable and like why we would want to do this, then I can't explain it to you.
Right. Like I can't give you the gift of joy.
Yeah.
The useless gets a bad rap because usefulness is very important for obvious reasons. We're all trying to survive and make the world – we're trying to survive first, and then if we survive well, hopefully make the world better for other people or, you know, things that take work and they take structure. But like to do a useless thing – that's
it's because we don't qualify usefulness the way we maybe should.
Yeah,
usefulness has to have some sort of tangible gain from it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really have a way of articulating, or we don't have a metric for what this gain is.
Yeah,
and that's the only difference. I mean, there is clearly gain here, but we're struggling to try and articulate it now, and we can't really do it because we just don't have the words for it. But there's a gain from this, and you feel it. Like you feel it, so it's part of you when you hear the stories about like. And then Anne just futilely was like, I'm gonna record the sounds of my body while I think about the feeling of being in love. And I want to give that to someone. I want to like gift that out there. And you're like, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And that's such a foolish thing because no one's gonna be able to decode that ever. But we inherently love it.
But it's her drive to do it. It's the drive of giving that gift.
Yeah.
It's giving something as a gift that isn't giving someone food as well. No, that's wonderful, but like giving somebody a jacket as a gift is really nice. Like giving somebody something that is wonderful and beautiful and has no purpose to them is so powerful.
Yes.
And this was just a wonderful, beautiful, purposeless thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like thinking about it a lot.
Yeah, me too, man. Me too. Okay, actually, I have a question we haven't touched on, and I always sort of pull back and forth about asking this to my guests, and I think it's a very important question for everybody, but I think my own experience with this sort of topic keeps me from asking because I have my own very strong opinions. But are you in any way a particularly spiritual person?
No.
Like, can you describe what that means to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think about spirituality as being like believing in something bigger than yourself, which I obviously I believe that there's, you know, that there are things bigger than us. None of it is necessarily conscious. It's not mm-hmm. like a conscious energy or mm-hmm. a conscious being that's bigger than us, but that when we are as a collective, we have something that's unifying all of us that's my understanding of spirituality. Mm-hmm. So like the idea that a sunset is beautiful, mm-hmm. Who cares? Like objectively, it's not. It's not anything.
Right.
It's just us, the planet turning slowly and the rays coming through the atmosphere and creating, it's sort of a different color when it hits the horizon. Mm-hmm. But we inherently all know it's beautiful. And like, where did that come from?
Right.
And that's I'd say that's the closest I come to spirituality. Mm.
I'm very much the same, like similarly, yeah. But I also, so I am, I guess why I ask is I am both an atheist and a philosophical materialist, but also I consider myself a very spiritual person through action. Like, I feel very spiritual feelings. Like, what we just talked about, what we've been talking about, this has been a spiritual conversation where we're talking about things that make us cry and make us feel sort of alive and joyful. And I think that's why I wanted to ask you that question, where mm-hmm. I normally wouldn't really ask it to most people.
Yeah. Well, I'd be curious also to know whether Carl Sagan would consider himself a spiritualist. Like, he's mm-hmm. I guess the idea of spirituality has just been co-opted by some
negative things.
And the connotations behind spirituality are all sort of silly and fanciful in a way mm-hmm. where I'm like, I don't need that in my life.
Right.
But knowing that you're very small and something much bigger than mm-hmm. you, and that you're still a necessary part of that cog, you're a necessary mm-hmm. cog in that machine.
Yeah.
Seems like a form of spirituality that I could get behind.
Right. I think it's unfair that the word spirituality either means Christ in confessionals or it means like shamanism at Burning Man.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I still think it's unfair that that gets to own that. And like, it can't just mean like us talking about space and Carl Sagan and the Golden Record and like bawling our little eyes out. Like,
yeah.
I think spirituality gets to be for everybody, even if you don't believe in the supernatural, which I do not.
It feels like a spirituality. The way I describe it, spirituality is like there's a bunch of just live wire, a bunch of wires.
Uh-huh.
And like, you can go through and you can like touch any of them, and like not all of them mean anything.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like, that's
yeah,
what
yeah.
Twitter is and everything. But every once in a while, you touch one, you're like, oh, there's an energy here.
Yeah,
and then you're and you don't necessarily know why, and you can kind of try and figure it out, but there's something coming out of this
uh-huh.
and there's something that we're sharing here that we can both feel if we touch it, and it's like an energy. And even if like I'm touching it and then I grabbed your hand, like then it would travel into you. Like there's something that's passing from it.
That's a good metaphor, Soren. I totally get that. Cause like some live wires don't, I was raised Jewish and grabbing onto that, you know, the live wire of Judaism doesn't necessarily do it for me.
Yeah.
It does now that I'm older and I think about like my heritage and stuff like that. But just being there when I was young, it didn't do it. But like this, clearly, grab it. It does it for me. You're grabbing it. It's doing it for you. We're grabbing each other's hands. It's just like looping. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Ah, shit. Okay. People, please watch Cosmos. It's amazing. Read any of Carl Sagan's books. They're really, truly beautiful.
There was an NPR did a very short radio lab that was like 7 minutes long mm-hmm. where they do – it was for Valentine's Day, and they do the Androian story, and she tells it, and it's really, really wonderful, and you can go find that.
I got to check that out. And yeah, anything by the two of them. What else? Soren, do you want to do plugs?
Sure.
Let's get some plugs from you.
You can watch American Dad. and you can also follow me on Twitter at Soren_LTD.
Great. Guys, you can follow this podcast on Facebook or Twitter at least pod, both of it. I'd love when people talk about each episode on Twitter. It really does a lot. This podcast is entirely spread through word of mouth. So if you happen to like an episode, share it with a friend, retweet it when I tweet it out. If you happen to hate an episode, then, you know, hey, man, we're all just small pieces in this giant universe. And really, it doesn't mean anything, but it means everything. if you guys are lying on a blanket with, you know, maybe a child or a significant other, you're out in the high desert and the sun is just starting to set. And hold on, let me put on the voice. Yeah. And the sun is just starting to set. As the beautiful spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy comes into view, I ask that you pull out your phone and go to At Least Pod, or At Least There's This, on the iTunes store and give me billions and billions of 5 stars.
Thank it's you. Actually millions and millions.
Yeah, it's actually millions and millions of 5 stars. Thank you, guys. You know what? I'm going to plug somebody who isn't me and I've never met. There's this dude named Louis Zhong, I think. He's on Twitter, but he's an illustrator, and he also makes really wonderful music that's been making my day just a little bit better. So check that dude's shit out. Why not? You have anybody else you would like check this guy's shit out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, is this something you picked up from Dan?
This is something I picked up from Dan, yeah. Dan and Robert, yeah.
Oh, Robert does it now too. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I love this idea, by the way. Give me 1 second.
And congratulations to Dan on his new job, by the way. That's big shit, yeah. He's writing for Last Week Tonight, or This Week Tonight. Damn it. The John Oliver
It is,
Dan.
Yeah, Last Week Tonight.
Okay, yeah.
Let me find her. Her tweets just fill me with joy.
Okay.
This is Rachel Andelman. You can follow her at RAJANDELMAN. And she's wonderful. She writes for The Reductress and A Reductress, and she writes for a couple of Mixed Queens and some other places. Yeah. And her tweets are they're always pure joy. Like, they come from such an absurd place and they're almost never pessimistic, and they brighten your day. It's such a nice reprieve on Twitter.
Okay, awesome. Guys, check those two people that Soren and I have never met out. And have a wonderful rest of your week. Bye.